Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this show, we gaze into the snow-blind hills and consider the place of winter in the arts. We catch up with the retrospective soundtrack players at the Portsmouth Square Tower, and we lurk out some New Year activities to get you in the crisp and even. Joining me as ever is the man whose season is permanently summer, a prophet of the Übergeist, a seeker of culture's soft footprints in the snow. It's the one and only Dave Allen.
Hi, James.
Welcome, Dave.
Thank you very much.
We're going to start this show, which is a winter-themed show. We thought, post-Christmas, we're moving into the post-Christmas blues, if you like, but we're going to consider winter. And to start that, to set the scene, to give folks a flavour of the kind of things we're looking at, the kind of things that we're going to be talking about, we're going to play, I think, possibly one of the shortest tracks that I could find, certainly the shortest track I could find about winter. This is a song by the Waterboys, so don't retune immediately, give me some time. This is a song from their 1993 album, Dream Harder. And it's a bit of a cheat, really, because if you're a Waterboys fan, you'll know this is only really Mike Scott and a number of session musicians. So there's something interesting there about maybe the last days of the Waterboys, or the winter, maybe, of their career. And we can make those kind of links. That's the kind of way that we're going. It was a strange album at the time. Had some interesting things on it. Had Glastonbury Song, if you can remember that. Had The New Life. And had a great song called Corn Circles. But the track we're going to play, because this is a winter-flavoured show, is Winter, Winter. And there's a great line in this song. Winter, winter on the way, hard and deadly thing. I'm going to let you have a listen now. So that was the Waterboys, very acoustic, very short, with Winter, Winter. And I guess, really, it kind of helps us set the scene and define some of the things that winter perhaps suggests. You know, winter is a point of closure. There's a real kind of melancholy to that song. But it's also, I think, suggesting a time of newness, of a new era, if we can go that way. It's also dark and reflective. So, Dave, let's start with you, because you and I have been, we've been mulling this over for some time. Winter in song, I think in classical music, winter's an established theme. Certainly seasons are well established in classical music. In pop music, what we can broadly call pop music, it takes all kinds of different routes.
Yeah, it does. In pop music, I think one of the strange things that has happened is that there are quite a lot of pop songs about winter which have been appropriated by the commercial interests of Christmas. So at Christmas, we listen to songs like, and you know, we have for decades listened to songs like Winter Wonderland, Let It Snow, Sleigh Ride, none of which actually refer to Christmas at all. That, you know, they are at any point in the season when it snows. And, I mean, I think there's another important point to make about something you've already raised with the Waterboys, which is the quite powerful sense of darkness and melancholy at winter, which, of course, is an entirely Northern Hemisphere phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mean that it's not dark in winter in the Southern Hemisphere, but it happens at a different time of year and in a different way. So I've come into the studio this morning, and anybody who listens regularly will know that I'm a bit of a cricket fan. I've come into the studio this morning in the deep, dark December day with rain and cold outside and so on. There are two test matches being played as I speak, you know, but they're being played in the West Indies and Australia. So it is a very Northern European thing to some important extent, and also the north of the United States of America. So winter, I think, is more New York than California, which we shall come to later, of course.
Well,
I think there are certain things that emerge from that, and one of them is melancholy. I think another is a kind of inherent romanticism, which permeates a great deal of stuff. I think there was a romantic feel to the Waterboys, and there will be to some of the other things we're going to listen to. And that goes back, certainly, to that great surge of romanticism at the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century in all of the arts.
And this may sound an obvious thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. Winter is very much, I think, determined by climate and environment. Yeah. So wherever your place is in the world, your winter experience will be very different. So that's an interesting angle, because, you know, winter for us, we kind of think of, November, December, January, okay? Yeah. But in other places, it's longer and shorter and very different. And that colours how it's expressed.
And our winter, to a large extent, we're sitting in the middle of the city of Portsmouth. If you live in big cities these days, in the UK, winter is fairly manageable. You know, the worst you've got to do is put on some snowshoes one day a year in Portsmouth. I mean, it may be more in Newcastle, but, yeah. You know, in Portsmouth, if you get more than one day snow and ice, you're unlucky, really, and we haven't had any so far this year. It can be a bit mucky and dirty and murky and so on, but it's manageable. You know, the Arctic winter is a whole different thing, and I'm not immediately sure that the arts have ever played with that to any great degree, although filmmakers have certainly played with those long Nordic nights, those nights when the sun never sets. And there's that Al Pacino film that I've completely forgotten.
I think it's called Insomnia. Is it Insomnia?
It is called Insomnia. Yeah. Well done. And I think that was based originally on a film made perhaps in Sweden or Germany or somewhere, where they play with a different experience of winter. The only thing about our winters, really, are that, you know, you can get the odd chilly day or the odd dark day. I've just, as you know, literally yesterday come back from a few days in Glastonbury, which you'd mentioned earlier. Glastonbury's really interesting because it's a kind of new age mystical wizards, witches, all kinds of astrological, you know, centre of the universe. I mean, I stood on Glastonbury High Street yesterday outside the main church there, and in a row on the other side of the road, trying to earn a penny or two, was a busker. It was a woman in kind of traditional English, very colourful, very flamboyant costume, playing English traditional fiddle music quite brilliantly. And so she was trying to collect coins. Next to her was a young woman with a child selling great boughs of mistletoe. Okay, not just like little sprigs that you get in the supermarket in Pompey, but great boughs of the stuff.
Yeah.
Next to them was a real blacksmith with a kind of portable forge that he was actually banging out Christmas presents and stuff with, you know.
And just travelled across counties, not across time zones.
It's just extraordinary when you think about it, because you can walk around the city of Portsmouth, 200,000 people in it, and not see a thing like that. And, of course, one of the key differences is that Portsmouth, because it's a big city, is commercial. So the shops are full of Christmas. You go to Glastonbury, and what they're really focused on in Glastonbury, as much as anything, is the winter solstice, not Christmas so much. And the solstice, of course, is a, you know, goes back into pagan times, and the solstice really does focus on the notion of darkness and the coming of the light, the shortest day. And that's the end of that suffering, if you like. And what they do is they have 12 days, traditionally, feeding and drinking and eating, and Lord of the Misrule takes over from the bosses, which would be a very good idea in this country at the moment. And, you know, they have the 12 days of Christmas, work that through, and then the days get lighter and warmer.
It's interesting, there's that, from my perspective, there is that element of connectivity, if you like, about winter that perhaps forces people more to think about their surroundings, or maybe the confines of their surroundings. And so, for some people, that's a very solitary thing, but it's also a spiritual thing. Now, whether that's just about, you know, the need to kind of seek shelter more because it's freezing and wet, or whether that's to do with, you know, maybe your brain gets colder and you start to be a bit more philosophical about your thinking. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think those are nice ideas. The notion of confines, that's a powerful one. I mean, certainly, you know, having got to the age I've got now, I'm far less inclined to go out partying in winter months than when I was a teenager. I didn't care, you know, if there was a great band at the Birdcage, I went. I didn't care if it was snowing, raining, ice, or whatever, you know. But yeah. Nowadays, I find an excuse not to travel somewhere. So, is the spirituality? It's a pretty amorphous thing, although it's interesting that, I mean, a lot of people who go to church at Christmas to sing carols don't ever go at any other time, unless there's a funeral or a wedding, you know. So there's a chance for some kind of, you know, contemplative time in the darkness, which I like that idea quite a lot, James. I think that's right. And, I mean, there's also that sense that it links in terms of nature with the whole notion of hibernation, you know, that we just shut down, close down. Now that I'm retired, I do that without any question, because I can, you know. I mean, in working days, you know, when I commuted to London, you know, I'd walk up to Fratton Station, slide up to Fratton Station on the 6th of January or something, get on a train that was delayed because the points were frozen and there was, you know, whatever else, and you just go to work like normal but struggle through it.
You've got less excuses now to crawl out of the cave, I guess.
Less excuses.
You put it that way. Yeah. You mentioned choral music, if you like, and the kind of the idea of carols and folk music.
Yeah.
And that kind of, I suppose, that kind of more traditional style of music. We're gonna play a track now, which is another one of our winter selection, if you like, which is a track called White Winter Hymnal by Fleet Foxes from their debut album from 2008. And I think this is the first single, really, that came out from their fold. And really, for that band, for Fleet Foxes, it kind of defines them. It's a very good example. If you've never heard Fleet Foxes, which is, you know, plausible, I suppose, you get a real sense of what they're trying to achieve. They, at the time when they recorded this, said that they wanted to get back to something more real. Now, that's quite broad, but I think what they were talking about is, again, we've touched on this, is it's that connectedness, if you like, that kind of something linking to nature, to the environment. And there is a real poetic, reflective feel to this. So let's give this one a spin, and then we'll get the cocoa out while it's playing. So that was Fleet Foxes with White Winter Hymnal. There's something in that song about the beauty of winter. You know, they're trying to create that landscape as an attractive, almost kind of pure, unsettled thing.
And they're stripped down, aren't they, in this, you know, modern age of beats and synthesized sound and so on and so on. I think they're not just a kind of singer-songwriter sound, but they are a stripped-down sound. They sound like an old folk group, but they're not. They're a contemporary. And I think it's fascinating that they don't call it White Winter Song. They call it White Winter Hymnal, which in some cases would seem to be the antithesis of hip, really, to call something hymnal. But they're part of that bearded beaty trend. I don't know that they're part of it. It seems to me they kind of anticipated it in a way. And there's even a Hampshire cricketer who looks like that now, so everybody's doing it.
There is something about that track which is tribal, in the sense that you can imagine walking through a field and suddenly hearing that kind of sound rise over the hawthorns, if you like, and thinking, ooh, there's something that's surrounding me, you know, that's almost right, kind of like a mist. And there's something quite nice about that. And spiritual, but not kind of in a religious sense, you know, very kind of human in some ways. There are a few other tracks looking at winter-based music, and you picked out a few interesting ones. One you picked was Aztec Camera's track,
Walk Out to Winter,
which is a real kind of, you know, you've always said to me, well, as long as we've been doing this show, if you can't dance to it, you're not interested. And you can definitely dance to this one.
You can dance to it, yeah. And I mean, it's not really true when I say that about dancing, but I do like music that kind of just, you know, even if you're sat in the seat and get your bum jiggling, I'm fond of that. And so I think there's an interesting point to make about that, because I think there is a tendency, partly because of this romantic thing, there is a tendency in contemporary popular music sometimes for people to make songs about winter that are necessarily melancholic and are struggling to find a kind of more optimistic take on it. And I think even if you just write a song that allows you to dance a bit, that's a... Because actually, you know, dancing in winter is a better idea than dancing in summer, because dancing in winter keeps you warm.
In or out of the cave, depending on whether you're hibernating. The other one you chose, which is always a bone of contention for me, was the Captain Beefheart
and
his magic band.
I couldn't resist picking it for that reason.
Steal Softly Through Snow, which is a crazy... I mean, most in context, most of the things he records or recorded were crazy.
He had a brief period, some 2 or 3 years after Trout Replica, where, and some of his band members talk about this, where he just, they all got sick of having no money and, you know, being a cult act that nobody actually bought or listened to. I think there was what was the album, Unconditionally Guaranteed, was probably the first album where he went more poppy, and it's very tuneful. It is a cult thing, and it's just a thing for people of my generation, Trout Replica, and it isn't something I rush home and put on, but I've now got sufficiently used to it that I can stick tracks on and kind of sing along with them and laugh.
This is a kind of difficult Christmas stroke winter single, I guess, for them.
Look it up on YouTube if you're that way inclined, but switch it off if you're not.
I think, just to treat you, Dave, because you need something to warm your cockles, I think we're going to play a little bit of Captain Beefheart to get the kids dancing at home.
Yeah.
You are listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, and Dave Allen with our winter special, focusing on the wintry representations in the arts, if you like. And Dave has been out and about having fun. We do let him get out and about nowadays. And you've been to see a really interesting band who I think are called the Retrospective Soundtrack Players.
They are. And
tell us about that.
I was just saying earlier, they don't go out in the winter, and there we were going out. But it was only down the road, because I live in Old Portsmouth, and it was one of these wonderful gigs at the Square Tower. And the Square Tower is a quite lovely historical venue. They've got, as it were, sort of two parallel spaces which are joined by archways anyway. But in one you can kind of sit in comfort and have a beer, and they were serving food and stuff. And it was all put together by the lovely lads at Pie and Vinyl.
We should give them a hurrah for the season.
I think we should give them a hurrah for every year, actually. Favourite place in Pompey every year, Pie and Vinyl, God bless them. So they put this together. Now, the explanation is this. Retrospective sound track players we will hear about in a minute, so I don't need to tell you a lot about them, but they're a kind of local act, and they've done, I think, three albums, and the idea is that they pick favourite stories from film and or fiction and make soundtracks for them that are not real soundtracks, if you like. So they're constructing these things. So they did Cool Hand Luke, the prison movie. They did another piece of cult fiction, you know, from recent times, Catcher in the Rye. They've done that as an album. This is their new album, It's a Wonderful Christmas Carol, which brings together the stories of Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens and It's a Wonderful Life, the film, by James Stewart. It was originally also a short story, and you can buy it now as a short story, but the thing everybody knows is the film. And they took some themes from that as particular tracks. So there's a theme at the start of the album, and then there's the story of the three ghosts, but there's also the track that we will hear is a line from the film, towards the end of the film, every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings. And they actually launched the album, I think, end of November. But early December, they had a kind of official launch party at the wonderful Square Tower. And I went down there with Mrs. A and my musical pal Dennis and his wife Lynn. We went for the evening. Had an absolutely wonderful evening. It was just brilliant. There was a young lady who performed first, and I apologise to her because I'm not sure what her name was. We didn't really get there in time to catch all that. Then there was a band called Day of the Rabblemen, who are a local kind of folk rock band, and they were really good. And then Retrospective Soundtrack Players, who simply played the album and actually had a little bit of time over, so they played two or three more songs as well. I loved the whole evening. I mean, there is that always that wonderful thing about hearing music live. I don't listen to a lot of music by 20 and 30 year olds nowadays. Occasionally I catch stuff. Sometimes I really like it, sometimes I don't. I think maybe the opportunity to hear it live was a good one. They used a number of singers. They were a very interesting band. They had a keyboard player who doubled on trumpet, and that really kind of lifted stuff out of, I wouldn't suggest in any way, predictable guitar bass sound, because it certainly wasn't that. They were very inventive and imaginative and very accomplished players. I thought they played beautifully. But those extra kind of textures and timbres that you get from those other sorts of sounds, particularly those trumpets, that was great. The singers were great. The words were well thought through. I thought they were a really intelligent band, but you could take that in a wrong way, because they were great fun. And you could tell that what had happened was a lot of their fans, local followers, had turned up and were having a good time. And my final bit of the story really is that the CD album is out, and you can certainly buy it in Pie and Vinyl, but as I understand it, the record company that released the CD don't normally do vinyl. So Pie and Vinyl came in on the act, as it were, and did a deal with them, and Pie and Vinyl have put out the vinyl version, which I bought because I like it.
Am I right in thinking it's beautifully bright red?
The vinyl, yeah, I was thinking of the cover, because the cover's quite muted grey, old Victorian-ish Christmassy kind of cover. But yeah, that's right. Yeah,
it's like a berry in the snow.
It's like that's very good.
The way to find it, isn't it?
That's very good.
You can. We'll put links to the album and some of the photos. You took some fabulous rock and roll photos for us while you were there.
I did get a couple of pics. Yeah, yeah. They certainly perform with a lot of energy. Yeah, I mean, they were.
And we're going to play one of their tracks after your interview. Just tell us a quick bit about the
track.
Well,
the track is that almost last line, that last conversation from It's a Wonderful Life, when James Stewart has just been rescued by all the townspeople and he's holding up his young child in his arms, and who says that every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings. And the Jimmy Stewart character says, George Bailey, he plays in the film, you know, George, you really had a wonderful life. And he's been rescued by the angel Clarence, who's now got his wings. And so George Bailey winks at the child and says, that's right, honey. And then he looks up to heaven or whatever and says, attaboy, Clarence, and that's the end of the film, you know. I'm completely sentimental about the film. I love it to death. Even more, actually, about Christmas Carol, which I read every Christmas without fail. And every Christmas there's a line in it somewhere that I just think, I don't remember that quite. And it's just beautiful and brilliant. But that's it. The track then is Every Time a Bell Rings, an Angel Gets Its Wings. And I like this particularly because it's kind of poguish. You know, it's kind of, rabble-rousing, folky. You can dance to it again, you know. So, and I like that kind of stuff. So it has a lovely feel to it. But, you know, I reckon the whole album's worth getting.
Well, we'll give that track a spin. But before that, here's how the young pretender himself got on when we let him out and about in Old Portsmouth.
I'm talking to Kyle, and you're the singer of the band.
Indeed I am, yes.
Tell me a little bit about the history of the band.
So this band started as a side project when I was doing my old band, which is called the Dawn Chorus, and we were taking a little bit of time out. I forget what it was for at the time, but my friend Neil, who produced all the Dawn Chorus and all the RSP records, sort of challenged me to do a solo album, and had this song I was working on, which was kind of based on the film Cool Hand Luke, one of my favourite films. And I was thinking, I don't really, it's a strange solo song, it's all about Cool Hand Luke, it's a bit weird. And then I got an idea to start writing another song about the same film, and then soon enough I'd written 10, 12 songs about this film, Cool Hand Luke, which seemed ridiculous. And then I thought, well, it clearly can't be a solo album now, because that's just odd. So I started a band instead, got 5 or 6 mates in, and to play the songs, and gave herself the most ridiculous name that no one can ever remember, and they lose interest between the first syllable and the last one, but it's been good fun.
Okay, but the project is memorable. I mean, there's been a lot of bands over the years, and I don't think any, I mean, lots of bands have played soundtracks, but the notion that you're constructing soundtracks that are imaginary, but to real things.
Yeah.
Because after Cool Hand Luke, you did?
We did The Catcher in the Rye, yeah, which was controversial. Some people, I mean, that's very sacred to some. I mean, yeah. And it's a bit hypocritical myself, because I have always said that there shouldn't be a Catcher in the Rye film, and that it would never. It's been so long that it would be awful. I'm sure it will happen at some point, but I don't think we're trying to. I think we're a very small concern, and B. I think we're trying to. What we do is quite odd. It's a different angle. It's sort of my interpretation on the book or film. So,
but you say hypocritical, but you're not actually making the films. You're merely making imaginary soundtracks, which is a rather different thing.
Well, sort of. I mean, the name is Retrospective Soundtrack Players, but the songs do detail. There is a narrative that follows the book or film in question. So, I mean, it's not. It's not background music, so to speak, like a soundtrack. So, but I think, you know, I would never take on anything that I didn't have a real deep respect for, and hopefully that comes through.
And tell us about tonight's project. It's the, what is it, the 7th of December, so we're fast approaching Christmas.
We are indeed. It's called It's a Wonderful Christmas Carol. I think I may have finally bitten off more than I could chew here, but but I've always been a huge fan of Christmas music. I've always wanted to write, to have a Christmas hit single. That's been like my tongue-in-cheek ambition so as long as I've been doing music. And I don't think we're going to have a hit single, but I wrote a whole Christmas album of original material. I don't think there's enough original Christmas material either. I've always loved It's a Wonderful Life and A Christmas Carol, and I'm no film or literary scholar, but there are a lot of obviously running themes in the two, redemption, etc. So I tried to weave the two together with a bit of mine and the band's personal experience. And yeah, I think it's probably the best thing that we've done, and it is a ridiculous concept, but I think it comes off well.
I've been in working bands all my life, which is a long, long time now. And I mean, I'm pretty used to all sorts of ways of putting gigs together and going out and playing songs. But
Does it present you with particular problems that you can't just kind of go and do a local pub gig and do, or do you? I mean, here's one from Catcher in the Rye and here's one from Paul Loop. Do you do those kind of gigs?
I think, again, when the size that we are, because we do still do a lot of gigs where, I mean, especially out of town gigs where people don't know an awful lot about us, or festival gigs where it's a crowd that aren't all sort of partisan already. So they don't really catch. You'd need to be really paying attention to think, hang on, half these songs are about Cool Hand Luke and half of them are about Catcher in the Rye. A, you'd need to have seen the film and read the book, which probably takes you down to about 1% of the population anyway. Then you've got to be at the gig and be paying attention, and by the time you've filtered out, really people can't tell. They okay. don't know what's. They
so,
don't notice.
So you do quite normal gigs yeah. where you mix that stuff up.
Yeah, we have done gigs where we mix it up, just go between the two records. So what we're going to do with the Christmas album as well, I don't know, but we'll cross that bridge and we come.
And is the album launched this evening?
Well, it's actually because the way things go, the release date was actually a couple of Mondays ago on the 24th to give it a good run up to Christmas, but we wanted people to have had the chance to have heard it before the show, so had the kind of launch show, as it were, a couple of weeks afterwards.
And your relationship with Pye and Vinyl and the way the album comes out?
My relationship with Pye and Vinyl, well, a couple of years ago a friend of mine told me that there was a shop opening in Southsea that was going to there's going to be an independent record shop for starters selling new music, which is, I think they're probably the only independent music shop that's opened in the UK, and well, I'd like to know, and maybe there's a couple of other ones I've actually opened in the last 5 years. I know there's they sell pies as well. It's like it was perfect for me. And then when I went in there on their launch weekend, Steve knew about the band, especially back then I was just sort of finishing my old band, the Dawn Chorus, and he was a fan. He'd seen us play, and I was very humbled that he came up and said that they wanted to sort of work with local musicians, and I've spent hundreds if not thousands of pounds in there in the last couple of years. And our album, we're signed to Extra Mile Recordings in London, but they don't do a lot of vinyl releases, so I sort of persuaded them, and there was a lot of fan persuasion that the album should come out on vinyl, and so the guys sort of stepped in and helped with that. So they've put out the vinyl version, and then Extra Mile have put out the CD and download version. It's perfect, really.
It is perfect. Well, bless them for that. I know that you're busy tonight, so I'm going to say thank
that's
you very
quite
much,
all right.
Kyle. And
that's
much
quite
appreciated.
All right.
I'm looking
thank you,
forward
Dave.
To it.
Church choir sings good. Cause every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings. I don't attempt to sound, it's always all profound. I've never had that much to say. Let's try to make the whole new year feel like today. Joy it brings. I don't believe in angels or religious things, but I still get so excited when the church choir sings. Cause every time a bell rings, an angel gets his way.
You are listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, and Dave Allen, trudging through winter and trying to get to grips with winter in the arts and culture, really. And we're moving now to poetry and painting, to kind of visual art. But we're going to start with poetry. Now, there are lots of poems and prose dealing with, trying to tackle, get to grips with winter. And Dave, you've picked out a couple of really good examples.
Yeah, I've got one or two things. There's a I hadn't even thought about this until you said something earlier. There is that classic line in Shakespeare, of course, now is the winter of my discontent, you know, although he, you know, again, he's linking winter and unhappiness with summer of, you know, all the rest of it. There's another thing from As You Like It by William Shakespeare that I won't read very much of this, but there's a poem in that called Blow, Blow Thou Winter Wind, which is, it's about a duke who's been dispossessed and sent into exile by a younger brother. And so this is a poem which is talking about the cold wind, the winter wind, but it's analogous to the mistreatment of people that you think are close to you. So, for instance, you know, it suggests that the wind, although thou the waters warp, thy sting, the wind sting, thy sting is not so sharp as a friend remembered not. And then Shakespeare gets cynical by saying, hey ho, sing hey ho, unto the green holly, so on and so on. This life is most jolly, but he's not meaning that, and he's playing around with that. So there's an American poet called William Carlos Williams who's written a quite lovely poem about January. Again, I reply to the triple wind's running chromatic fifths of derision outside my window. Play louder, you will not succeed. I am bound more to my sentences the more you batter at me to follow you. And the wind, as before, fingers perfectly its derisive music. It's about the threat of winter and so on, but he's actually reflecting on the process of writing there, you know, that whatever you do, I am bound more to my sentences the more you batter at me. And is it the wind outside, or is it, you know, it's that struggle to write, that struggle to get the words out.
We've talked a bit about the kind of the darkness, if you like, of winter and the kind of melancholy, but there is a negative, and there is a cynicism, isn't there, that comes through a lot of the work, you know, and it's self-deprecating in some ways, isn't
it? Yeah, in some ways it is. Maybe it's an excuse in, you know, as we said, in the Northern Hemisphere, it's an excuse to wallow almost in that sense of self-pity and misery and so on and so on, and you know, I mean, the ordinary everyday common sense of it is that you bump into somebody in the street and grumble about the wind, the rain, the ice, or, you know.
That certainly goes on in Portsmouth.
It certainly goes on in Portsmouth, yeah. Although I would have to say that one of the great pleasures of my life in Portsmouth, and it's been a long life in Portsmouth, is walking the seafront at high tide in wild weather. I just think it's stunning, particularly around Old Portsmouth, where it just smashes up against those walls and beaches and things. Just think it's brilliant. I think it's quite as beautiful as a midsummer's blue hot day.
It's that connectivity again, isn't it, with kind of brilliant. With nature, really, yeah. Even if you're just having a walk along the seafront.
I think maybe that's the trick. Maybe cities are a bit depressing and a bit messy in winter, but actually nature. I had, you know, again, as I said, come back from Glastonbury, walked yesterday morning in a cottage garden, a big cottage garden, with Glastonbury Tor towering over it. And it was about 8:30 in the morning, and it was a beautiful morning yesterday morning. It wasn't windy and wild, and there was mist everywhere.
Mm.
It was just stunning, because just here and there the sun broke through and was hitting a kind of rust-red tree, which was really vividly bright, and elsewhere it was shrouded in that kind of 19th century romantic mistiness.
Mm.
Just, you know, again, not the thing you could see in summer. Quite beautiful.
There are a couple of other poems that I wanted to mention. I took advice on this from, let's just say, from a fraternal source. And there are a couple. There's a poem, Winter Fields, by John Clare. And there's an adjective in this, which I like. And it was pointed out to me. The word hurkles is used. And the context there is, then on with frequent jump he hurkles through. Hurkles, what a great word. What a great word to use. A really wintry word in some ways.
It'll be our word for
it'll
the week.
It'll be our word of the week.
Whatever
maybe.
It means, it'll be that word.
We'll look that one up. The other poem was the Robert Frost poem, which was Desert Places. And again, we'll put links on our blog, towardsthepoint.blogspot.co.uk, so you can find all these kind of links. But there's another Frost poem, a great name, nominative determinism.
Absolutely.
Comes into it here, but it's a great wintry poem that you've dug out, Dave.
I love it. I'll read it. This is a poem by Robert Frost called Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, and there are four verses. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. A couple of things. One is structure. It describes a quite ordinary scene, if you think about it, in terms of people, you know, riding horses and through frozen countryside and so on. But the structure of it is quite brilliant. So, for example, in the first three verses, he uses a rhyming word at the end of the first, second, and fourth lines. So the first verse has no, though, and snow. But the third line never rhymes. So the third line there is here. So you get no, though, here, snow. What happens, though, is that the third line always rhymes with the first, second, and third, fourth lines of the next verse. So where you get here in the third line of the first verse, it rhymes with queer, near, and year in the second, and so on, which is quite brilliant, because it's a clever formal structural thing, but it doesn't destroy the narrative. The other significant thing that people are suggesting about it is that the repetition of the last two lines, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep, maybe to do with an analogy between not simply travelling and having to go on to get a bed for the night, but actually the notion of winter as the end, you know, the dying of the year, which works again particularly well in the Northern Hemisphere and doesn't work so well if winter's in the middle of the year, but it's the dying end of the year. And this is a traveller who's conscious of the fact that he's travelling on and that eventually one day he won't be here any longer. It's beautiful, I think.
And always difficult, I think, to link poetry, classic poetry like that, to music. But we're going to have a go.
Have a go.
And I've been delving around in the music bucket, as it were, and there's a track that I can remember coming out. It came out in October 2006, which isn't that long ago, but seems like a lifetime away to me. It's a track called February Snow. So there's a snow link. It's by a band called Fell City Girl. They don't exist anymore, but the protagonist of that band, Phil McMinn, has recently, in fact, in January of this year, January 2014, released a kind of collected EPs compendium, if you like, of that band. I really like this song. I really loved it when it came out, and I had great hopes for this band and the kind of things that they would do. They disappeared. It's very difficult to find anything about the band itself online, but there's a real fragility about this song, and it's really quite a frank, stark, I suppose, depiction of a relationship that's in its winter and coming to its end. We're going to have a little excerpt of it now. That was Fell City Girl and a track called February Snow. Now we're going to move on now to visual art, and I think really by that I mean painting. And we could have a debate, we have had several debates in this studio about whether that's right or wrong. And I thought about considering winter in paintings, and classic paintings, and paintings that I know. I think really paintings that I perhaps have a relationship with. And there's a couple that I picked out, and Dave instantly told me he doesn't like the first one, which I think it's got to be a good thing in some ways, because if everyone agreed with each other, what a world we would be in. The first painting I wanted to mention, which is a real snowy, wintry scene. Snow and winter seem to go together, but they don't always, depending on where you are. But this is a Edvard Munch painting, and it's called New Snow in the Avenue from 1906. And just to describe it very briefly to you, it's a classic kind of Munch perspective. It's a tree-lined avenue. It's full of really kind of dull purples and reds, really kind of quite visceral in some ways. And there's two figures who are walking towards you. They're kind of walking away from something, almost like they're leaving a season behind them, which is an interesting perspective. There is a big blobby pink circle. I believe that's a low winter sun. I think that's what I found. But a big blobby circle is how I'm going to describe it. So that's one. Again, we'll put it on our blog. But one I really like, if you look at it, you think, oh, it's just a painting, it's just a picture. You know, you could quite happily see that on a Christmas card if you like. But there's a lot to it, and there's something in there which is, you know, as usual for Munch, there are mental themes, if you like. There are spiritual themes. You look at the clouds, look at the trees, look at some of the kind of the merge, if you like, that he has created in that landscape. So that was one I wanted to mention. And the other one I wanted to mention, which is similar, a similar vein, is Kandinsky's Winter Landscape from 1909. It's just a great winter picture, and I think what I like about the Kandinsky picture is that you assume that winter's colour is always white and blue and black and kind of dull purple and red. But this is very vibrant in terms of it. You know, it's yellow and it's green and it's red, and it's got a really nice mix. Now, Dave, you by trade are a connoisseur of the arts. You're many things, and there are paintings that you've picked up on that perhaps depict winter for you.
Yeah, there's a classic. I suppose the first really famous winter picture is probably by Bruegel the Elder, and it's called Hunters in the Snow, which everybody will know. It's about, you see pictures of hunters in the snow on a hilltop looking down on a village, a very well-known piece from hundreds of years ago. The thing that particularly interests me that I've alluded to on a couple of occasions is the extent to which winter becomes a focus for the romantics of the early 19th century. And so, and there are, I mean, you can just Google this really and find them, but there are some great pictures by the two wonderful English painters, Turner and Constable. Constable particularly, because I'm going to spend a bit of Christmas around there, there's a painting of Brighton Beach in winter, and it's reputed to be one of the few paintings that he made out of doors in the winter. So he would often make sketches and then go indoors and work them up because it was too cold. But I'm going to give Turner a mention, partly because I think that the film that came out about Turner this year was my favourite movie of the year as well. But Turner's made great, great paintings of snowstorms, both in this country and indeed things like Hannibal crossing the Alps. You know, I mean, interesting, one of the things we haven't talked about is winter in history, you know, and there are a couple of stories. One is Hannibal crossing the Alps. The other is Napoleon's retreat from Moscow, which was entirely, well, not entirely, but to a large extent determined by adverse winter conditions. And there's probably many other examples of that kind of thing as well. So, you know, early 19th century romanticism, the German painter Caspar David Friedrich is a quite wonderfully evocative romantic painter. Then in the later 19th century, you get quite a number of snow scenes and winter scenes by the Impressionists, Pizarro and Monet and even Van Gogh, which with Van Gogh, it takes us into the two you've talked about, into Expressionism in the early 19th century.
Blobby paintings.
And I've got two other much more contemporary things, which takes us from painting to three-dimensional art, to sculpture. One is, you can see a YouTube video of this moving, and it's an Alexander Calder mobile of snowflakes falling, which is rather sweet. And the other is somebody that people may well have heard of, a land artist as opposed to a landscape artist, not depicting the landscape but working in the land, is Andy Goldsworthy, who's particularly famous, and he does stuff with icicles and snow and frozen ice, and he basically uses the ice and water as his glue to make sculptures that will not survive forever. He then photographs them. They're quite beautiful things.
Now, just before we go, we're getting to the end of our winter programme, I wanted to just mention an event I think you should check out in 2015. There's an open day at the King's Theatre in Southsea on Saturday the 17th of January, and it's a showcase from 3 o'clock, but the doors are open at 10 o'clock. You can go along to the King's Theatre, and it's open access. The tickets for that are £5 for a single ticket, or £12 for a family ticket, and you can check out more information about that on their website, which is kingsportsmouth.co.uk. Now, when we were discussing winter and winter as a theme, we kind of got thinking about what's the best expression of winter in a pop song, okay? Now, it's difficult because, you know, the minute you kind of put that badge on something, something else crops up or you think of that something. Now, Dave and I think are broadly in agreement that this is a very good example of a winter classic. It's also an anthem, I think, for counterculture. So you've got this kind of, you know, it is a demonstration of a seasonal shift, a cultural shift as well, which is an interesting thing to consider. It's been covered by hundreds of people, including REM and Raquel Welch. Can you believe that?
I didn't know.
Well, there we go. And it came from the Mamas and the Papas' debut album, which was called If You Can Believe Your Eyes and Ears, which came out in 1965, which is a long, long time ago. And it was a hit in 1966. The song that we're talking about is California Dreaming. And we think this is a real depiction of a winter's day. You know, that's where kind of where it starts. You've got some recollections of this.
Well, I remember it when it first came out, I'm sorry to say. I love it. I think it's great. I think it's very evocative. I think what's interesting about it is it's the complete opposite of White Christmas. Because what happens on when Berlin wrote White Christmas, he was in California and longing to be in New York with snow. So he's dreaming of a white Christmas, whereas John Phillips, or whichever one of the Mamas and Papas wrote this, is in some grey part of the world somewhere dreaming of sunshine. So it's the complete turnaround. Yeah, it's interesting, but it wouldn't work unless it was set on a day a bit like today, really. A bit damp, bit soggy, bit grey, not quite cold enough to be crisp and bright and all the rest of it, isn't it? It's that sort of thing, and thinking, oh, I wish it was the middle of summer.
It's a heartwarming track. We're going to play it very soon, but before we go, we must just tell you that our next show will be broadcast on Monday, the 26th of January, 2015, at 7 o'clock. You can check out all the things that we've been talking about and so much more, a show archive as well, on our blog, towardsthepoint.blogspot.co.uk. Our thanks to all of our contributors across 2014, and our congratulations to co-conspirator Simon Mobbs on the arrival of his new daughter, which is very exciting. And also seasonal worship to Dave Allen, who's been a steady force throughout. We're going to move to California Dreaming, but before that, it's just down to me to say that Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.